So I think that presentation makes you feel a little bit more comfortable. We're like in family. I am Dr. Novello. I am the 14th U.S. Surgeon General, the former commissioner of the state of New York during September 11, and currently I just retired from the executive director of public health policy implementation at Florida Hospital Orlando. And so I have been asked to moderate this panel, and basically it's going to be an interesting morning presentation because the title of Surgeon General conveys authority, and the title of State Surgeon General will compel us to also have the authority behind that to be able to do something unique apart from just being the Commissioner of Health. So today we're going to present you four different patterns, four different things that happen. For example, we know that there are three states currently that have a State Surgeon General. The very first was Dr. Wisdom in Michigan, then Dr. Bahamonde in Florida, and then Dr. The one from Arkansas, Joe, which is not here. And so the important thing about this is that each one of them had a different way by which they got to the post. So some of them, all of them approved by the governor, some of them approved by the state legislature, and some of them just appointed in case the director of health was not a physician. So every state utilizes the model of their advantage to be able to make this a reality. So the reason for which we're here is to be able to present you the experiences of the three ones that have been here, and also come up with a conclusion of a meeting that we did with terrific stakeholders pertaining this particular topic to see if there could be a pilot study implemented in other states in where this model can be put across for the nation. So after they present their experiences and their recommendations of their other way that they have done their office, it would be interesting to come up with what we have gained from their presentations and the stakeholders that came about, and then come with questions and answers of the possibility, would this is the kind of thing that could be implemented where you work, and if so, how can it be utilized to advance public health at the local level, public health, at the coalescence of states who have the same border, and people keep coming into your state to take a little bit of their Medicaid, and then could we be also the force to help the current United States Surgeon General when the problems are so big that only one person cannot do it? So it seems to me that the connotations of the presentations are crucial, and the connotations of what could be used for if we use the state model for the land in the presence of ACA and in the presence of post-ACA implementation. And that's why we're here today. So I am going to immediately go into the curriculum vitae of the persons that are here so that you realize who they are and what is, bypass the others. There, we are none of us has an interest, conflict of interest that is relevant. We are going to, as we did, take the four models, tell you the achievement and challenges, and then demonstrate the unique position of the State Surgeon General, which we already covered. These are the speakers. Dr. Kimberly Dunn, the first ever State Surgeon General during Governor Grisham from Michigan. Then Dr. Bahamonde, the first woman and Cuban ever Hispanic in the state of Florida, the state of Florida, to be able to be the State Surgeon General, nominated also by the governor and approved by the legislature. And then Catherine Winger is going to be able to talk about the stakeholders, what has been found, and the conclusions for future development. She is the one that basically has the cumulative knowledge of all that has pertained and the comprehensive meetings that have happened to get this where we are today. So remember, as I told you, Michigan was appointed by the governor, a separate position from the director of Michigan Department of Community Health. Florida was appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature, a dual role in one post. Arkansas was appointed by the governor to be the chief health advisor as codified in Arkansas General Assembly, but he is the key because he does government and academia. It seems like he's one of those posts that really outgrows just doing the vaccinations. And then in Pennsylvania, in the event that the Department of Health is not a physician, which happens in many states, and I wish them the best, the governor appointed a physician general to advise the Secretary of Health, codified in statute. So you can imagine the difficulties of these people in the audience trying to do their job when there is two people for the same title in one budget and a whole bunch of envy because they are the communicators that the public trust. Dr. Wisdom is going to be the first with the model of an innovation in leadership for public health. Dr. Bahamonde is going to be number two, the Florida experience. Catherine Whitger will be the challenges and opportunities. And at the end, we're going to have a real informal discussion whether this pattern can be applied to you. And if so, how can we help you to be able to do this? And then if there are more questions that we cannot cover, then we'll give you the name of Barbara so you can really trace her and continue the communication. So Dr. Wisdom is the first female Surgeon General. She is, let me tell you a little bit about her so you can see, like we say in New York, she's no chopped liver.
We also mentioned there's a handout at the back of the room that lays out the four state models. The Surgeon General
and it's distributed down three.
Dr. Wisdom is the Senior Vice President of Community Health and Equity and Chief of the Wellness and Diversity Officer at Henry Ford Health System and Chair of the Gail and Lewis Warden Endowment of Multicultural Health. She's a board-certified emergency physician who practiced for 20 years at Henry Ford System in Detroit, and she also founded and directed both the Institute of Multicultural Health at Henry Ford Health System and a National Minority Quality Forum Award-winning community-based health screening initiative for men titled African American Initiative for Male Health Improvement, which focused on improving the health of those disproportionately affected by the poor health outcomes. She's also an assistant professor of medical education at the University of Michigan and an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education. Dr. Wisdom.
Thank you so much, Dr. Novello. What do you think about Dr. Novello? She's a rock star, isn't she? She's just the best, and that's why we wanted her to moderate this session, and we've invited her to our forum that we had at NASPE, the National Academy of State Health Policy, Kathy Whitger and her group assembled. So we think this is so key to have someone of her reputation involved. I want to start off with a quote that Einstein said many, many years ago. He said, "The significant problems that we face today cannot be solved at the same level of thinking that we were at when those problems were created." So, I contend that the significant challenges that we face today cannot be addressed without having a leadership model, a new and innovative leadership model that didn't exist when those problems developed. And I think that innovative public health leadership model, one of those could be a state Surgeon General. Now, you all have read the headlines, and you've seen things that have said the obesity epidemic, where the first generation, this may be the first generation of children that may not outlive their parents. You've heard about Ebola. You've heard about type 2 diabetes in children, which didn't exist several decades ago when many of us trained in medicine. You've heard about SARS, you've heard about climate change, you've heard about health disparities, you've heard about pandemics, you've heard about global health. 2 decades ago, none of these words existed. So the charge is, how do we address today's problems without significantly addressing the leadership model? And I say in medicine, we have antibiotics, and as the germs change, we have a next generation of antibiotics. The same thing for healthcare. As the challenges change, we need to have the next generation of public health leadership. Now let me take you back a little bit. This is not a new concept in terms of this conversation. This was back in 2004, and I was the only state Surgeon General at the time, and was very anxious to talk with others to see about promoting this state level Surgeon General model. Dr. David Satcher, you see in the back there, he was very instrumental and played a major leadership role. You see Dr. Antonio Novello, you see Dr. Richard Carmona, you see Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders, and Dr. Julius Richmond, who unfortunately has since passed away. But this has been a concept that we've been vetting and socializing for several years now in terms of its value. And of course, this is before ACA. So the challenges that we face need a new and innovative leadership model. Actually, this was at Dr. Satcher's home, just prior to having a session with all of the U.S. Surgeons General, current and former. I want to mention that the first day on the job as Michigan's first state-level Surgeon General, you had instant credibility, and we'll be talking about this more as we provide our reports. the invited, I had over 100 speaking engagements day one when I walked into the office. Front page newspaper articles, people wanted to come visit, people wanted to learn more, people, national networks wanted to have conversations. So the position has amazing traction and amazing credibility. And I knew then that the post had significant untapped challenge in terms of the ability to communicate, to convene, as well as to collaborate. The role as Surgeon General of Michigan, it was sort of building a plane while you're flying it. There had been no precedent in the country, so that's why I reached out to Dr. Satcher initially. But initially it was outlined that it would serve as a chief public health advocate, rebuild the public health system, which was oftentimes broken and fragmented, develop public health policy, and also build collaborative partnerships. So as an emergency medicine physician, when the governor tapped me, she had a long list of things I want you to address: unintended pregnancy, childhood obesity, HIV/AIDS, tobacco prevention and control, diabetes, sexually transmitted diseases, a whole laundry list. So beginning to sort that those efforts out was challenging. It was daunting for as a emergency medicine physician, but it was not defeating. It was like we can shape this, we can do something here. So I'm going to briefly go through some of the achievements of the post, as others will, in terms of their efforts. I want to start off by talking about the last two items, the Childhood Lead Poison Prevention Task Force. Just to mention, six bills were passed as a result of convening that task force. All of them to protect children from childhood lead poisoning. Bills such as penalizing landlords for knowingly poisoning children by having not had lead apartments and housing remediated. We developed a mandate to require lead testing for children that were in inner city. We, the blueprint for preventing unintended pregnancy, we convened a task force that addressed unintended pregnancy. We developed clinical guidelines, a governmental agency developing clinical guidelines, unprecedented. Also, we wrote 1115A waivers and received those those funds as well. Just a few others I'm going to walk through. In order to put shape to the post, the prescription for a healthier Michigan was written. And this was about a 20 plus page document. It's interesting because I mentioned to the governor I wanted to write a prescription, and she thought it was going to be a small one pager. And Kathleen Sebelius, who was the governor of Kansas at the time, kept saying, I want to see what this prescription is. It took several months for it to be written, and it was a collaborative, collective effort. But it was provided a framework from which the post could launch its efforts. Promoting healthy lifestyles, protecting families, protecting communities, and eliminating health disparities, which was key, a key underlying cross-cutting element. And there were specific recommendations for each sector. So whether it was the business sector, the governmental sector, schools, healthcare, communities at large, there were instructions for what each one of those elements could provide. We also launched, in terms of the effort to promote healthy lifestyles, a campaign called Michigan Steps Up that addressed many, many elements, but also then again invited various sectors to be involved. We developed a website. We had, just in the first year or so, over 30,000 people sign up on the website and participate by filling out a survey and saying that they want to be part of the campaign. We were very fortunate to receive from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation a $5 million grant. And we labeled that to address childhood obesity and empowering middle school youth to drive policy, environmental, and behavioral changes. So the post attracted significant funds, and that effort continues now to this day through other support through USDA and the Michigan Fitness Foundation. So in 2010, we actually at APHA reported our findings of a case study. Several colleagues at the University of Michigan School of Public Health said, why don't we do a case study? This is probably 2008 and on your post. And I said, fine, I will give you every email I had. I had a special email box, no personal email boxes. But I had a special email box just for Surgeon General emails. I gave them access to every email, to every speech that was given, to every letter of invitation, and they actually did a deep dive and did a lot of interviews of various people to develop a case study on the post. Overall, there was tremendous support for the idea of a state-level Surgeon General. Stakeholder involvement and political support for the position we identified during that initial report was critical, and you'll be hearing more about that during others' presentations. And the short and long-term successes to sustainability rely on the ability to institutionalize it, codify it, being very transparent, and elements of accountability that you'll hear more about. So a couple recommendations, a clear appointment process in terms of how the position is shaped and the appointment process. A legal basis for gubernatorial and legislative approval, so the codification aspect. Clear job description, as you know, being the first, there was no job description specifically, there were assignments, but the ability to have very specific deliverables in terms of even elements to measure. Guiding principles for strategic planning and also annual reports, which are very similar to what the U.S. Surgeon General provided. Then in 2013, we actually began an effort to write a white paper. So there were, this is a team of people that were involved, Dr. Peter Jacobson from the School of Public Health, Health and Law, Professor Lauren Marshall, who was a student at the time, now she has since received both degrees, and Barbara Bloom, who's actually here in the audience, who's been just a major leader and guide through this effort in terms of us doing the second study, which is a white paper. Just a bit of the methodology related to the white paper, and I also do want to mention that you may wonder how these efforts are funded. We have funding through the Gail and Lois Warden Endowment that I currently hold, so that is how we've been able to provide funding to have these convenings and to support this ongoing effort. And he was a key person that was instrumental in wanting to promote the state Surgeon General post. Methodology. We did a qualitative data analysis. We did 14 interviews of the individuals and professionals cited here, the former and current U.S. State Surgeons General, former U.S. Surgeons Generals, as well Surgeons General, public health organizations, both nationally in Michigan and those involved in state policy. Also, there was a significant literature review done, looking at the gray literature as well. Some of our findings, governance considerations. It was very clear that one size does not fit all. If you are addressing one state, you're really addressing one state. So we couldn't necessarily consider a model that would be absolutely the exact same model across every state. Legislative codification, control over budget, and need to need depends on the existing public health structure. So some states have super agencies, some are organized very very differently, and so you need to target, you need to design things based on the infrastructure of the state. Person has to have interpersonal, strong interpersonal relationships with the governor, with of course they have qualities bringing medical expertise, but actually the communication and the ability to collaborate I think is actually much more key than actually clinical, having tremendous clinical expertise alone. And of course, the role of the political environment, political independence, being able to address healthcare reform, as well as be the state health lead. And of course, you can't have opportunities without some element of challenges. So several of them are listed here, and it was difficult to, from an attribution, we had an attribution problem, it was difficult to attribute what a particular, as bills were passed and as efforts moved forward, whether it was tobacco tax or those sorts of things, it was hard to exactly attribute what role the Surgeon General played to those. And also the benefits of prevention do not occur, you don't see those benefits for sometimes, you know, many, many years and several decades, so it's hard to quantify prevention. There were challenges around budget and staffing, because some people felt that, you know, it was expanding government, and yet it's a very, very, very inexpensive model that we can address during our Q&A period. Was there overlap with existing positions, such as the director of the department or the commissioner? Current trends towards distrust in government intervention. So the question of can you trust a government appointee? Diversity of health state goals was one of the key challenges. Every state may have different goals. However, with Dr. Thompson, Dr. Viamonte Ross, and me within Michigan, we're all focused on childhood obesity prevention, but we all approach it in very different ways. So we all had the same goal in that respect, however, we were approaching it in very different ways. And then also the decline of the U.S. Surgeon General's authority. So just in closing, I'm just going to provide a few quotes from various respondents since we did those 14 interviews. And one said, just the title garnered a lot more respect and authority, not only in the public health community, but in the medical community as well. So certainly a bridge builder between public health and medicine. Real integration of clinical care and population health. It put a stamp of importance on public health. Of course, many times people think public health is invisible, or it's just putting a lid on a garbage can, or addressing the needs of the underserved. But it put a stamp on the importance of public health and health in general in a way the department director can't. And may not be able to keep the state health officer out of politics, but a Surgeon General can. So the Surgeon General can really sort of be under the radar in some circumstances and also rise above the radar because they're the trusted scientific voice for the public. So why the state Surgeon General post? Trusted, respected, the people's doctor. The title actually garners a lot of respect, and it's not about the prestige, but it's about getting the attention of the people that you want to hear the message. A credible voice, scientific voice, the use of the bully pulpit is extremely powerful. A neutral convener, so they didn't have a particular bias necessarily. It was how can we improve the health of our entire community, our entire state, and can work across the aisle without political ties as a scientific voice. So I remember very clearly related to our childhood lead poisoning efforts, and they asked me to present before the House Judiciary Committee because we wanted to penalize the landlords that were knowingly poisoning children, and they were very much against that legislation. And then after about 2 hours of being grilled by the House Judiciary Committee, they decided to rule in favor of that legislation, and it ultimately passed. So key role in terms of that scientific voice. Standardization of processes and programs, in terms of even the framework that I talked about, the prescription for Healthier Michigan, tremendous opportunity there. Key spokesperson, the ability to generate reports that people often use when they're writing for research proposals and working on their dissertations. Attract research funding. As you see, we received a $5 million grant and other small grants in the interim. And accelerate change and drive population health are some of the key elements that are kind of more specific to that particular post. So at this time, I want to thank you for your attention. I want to turn it over to Dr. Ana Viamonte-Ross, or actually turn it back over to Dr. Novello to introduce Dr. Viamonte-Ross.
Thank you so much, Dr. Novello.
I think as you listen to these presentations, you realize that you're in the right place to listen to the right message on the right day, because this really has the potential for doing really great things in the field of public health for the future. So now, the second Surgeon General at the level of the state is Dr. Ana Viamonte-Ross. She's Associate Dean for Women in Medicine and Science at the FIU Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine and Director of Medical Staff Development at the Baptist Health South Florida. Dr. Viamonte-Ross was Florida's first state Surgeon General and the first woman and the first Cuban American to serve as the head of the Florida Department of Health from 2007 to 2011. Her primary responsibility was to oversee one of the most comprehensive public policy healthcare systems and Florida's largest single clinical enterprise. She was charged by Florida governor, and she acted as the state's leading advocate for wellness and disease prevention, achieving multiple victories in leading the state to higher levels of awareness and actions on women's health issues. Dr. Viamonte-Ross earned her medical degree in 1983 from the University of Miami School of Medicine and graduated with several awards and honors. And in 2005, Dr. Viamonte-Ross received her Master's of Public Health degree from the Harvard School of Public Health, where she was recipient of the Gareth Green Award for Excellence in Public Health. Dr. Viamonte-Ross.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be with all of you this morning. As you've heard this morning, and you will continue to do so, we have very different models that you will see, and mine was a very comprehensive model, you'll see in just a moment, The Department of Health and the Department of Children and Families was created back in 1996 from a very mammoth department that was called the Florida Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services. Then, by executive order in 2007, the post of State Surgeon General was created by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. All statutory references to the Department of Health Secretary were changed and revised to State Surgeon General. All the department employees, including all the county health departments, which I'll show you in just a moment, are all state government workers. The position of the Department of Health State Surgeon General reported directly to the governor. And also, however, the governor had the ability to assign not just to the Department of Health, but to all the state agencies, a chief of staff position, which I think operationally they controlled and wanted to make sure that things were well covered and their priorities were the priorities of each of the state secretaries and departments. We have a central office. It's located in Tallahassee. You can't see it here on the map, but it's the state of Florida's capital is in very northern part of the state, very close actually to the Georgia border. It's a small college town, but that's the seat of government, and it was selected because it was historically midway between Pensacola and Jacksonville, which were some of the earlier settlements of Florida. If I think were to be done now, it would be much more logical because of our population to have a more centrally located state capital like Orlando. We don't have great airports in Tallahassee either. But anyways, that's where our state government is housed. The primary function of the central office headquarters was to develop a policy and provide direction to the department's staff. We had approximately 16,000 employees, 2,500 of which were located in our central office in Tallahassee. Some of the divisions, we had about 11 divisions, four standalone offices, two standalone bureaus, but some of them included disease control, environmental health, disability determinations, public health research, minority health, Bureau of Laboratory Services, and pharmaceutical services. You're going to see now that we also had one TB hospital located in South Florida. It has since 2 years ago closed down. But we were responsible for that as well as our strategically placed public health laboratories. Some of the policies, some of the responsibilities that we had were, as I said, policy development, providing leadership, because we truly did provide direct services. Unlike many other states, the Department of Health in Florida and many southern states provides within our county health departments primary care services, and that's why we were the largest clinical enterprise in the state right now. We had total authority over our budget in the position I was in, so because not only was I, as I said, the public health advocate, but also the operational head of the department. Let me see here. And some of the achievements we were able to effect were a very robust tobacco education and prevention program. We developed a physician workforce assessment initiative. We had the corrections department partner with us in order to provide 340B pricing and certainly saved a tremendous amount of money for the incarcerated population, and certainly our response to emergencies, and I'll go through each of these in just a moment. First, our tobacco education and prevention program. This was established in the Constitution back in 2006, and in 2007, our legislature in Florida directed the Department of Health to implement totally the program. We were funded at approximately $60 million annually, and we had not only the counseling services, all types of prevention initiatives. We had quit lines, we had nicotine replacement patches, really all sorts of tools were available for our initiative. And because of that, since 2006, the adult smokers in Florida, the rate has fallen from around 18%, while the youth rate had fallen approximately 19.5%. That initiative continues to this day. It did have a positive economic impact for the state of Florida, generating jobs as well as revenues. The practitioner workforce development was something that was done under my tenure, and it's something, it's a survey that's embedded within our relicensing program for our physicians, both osteopathic and allopathic. In fact, I renewed my license 2 days ago, and I had to fill out our survey. And the purpose really was to understand the actual number of physicians, where what they were working in, the areas that they were working in, why they chose to see or not see Medicaid patients, whether or not they take calls, whether or not if they're OBGYNs, they're still doing OB or not, whether liability issues affect their practice. So all of that, we knew anecdotally what was happening throughout the state, but we needed to really substantiate and have data for that. And now it's embedded directly in our relicensing program and certainly has helped us address the physician workforce issues in the state of Florida with hard data. Also, the Department of Corrections, I had had some correctional health background before I started in my position, and we realized that if a certain segment of inmates became Florida Department of Health patients, in other words, we provided care for them as well as owned their records, we would be able to provide them a 340B pricing in a lot of their medications. So we did that. We got a certain a federal dispensation. This was the first it was ever done at the national level from Washington, and we started a pilot program where, again, because we were in the clinical medical job, a lot of these patients, once they were released back into the communities, did become our patients in the county health departments. So from a continuity of health perspective, it made sense totally. So we started in 9 of the largest penitentiaries, and these individuals became our patients while they were incarcerated, and certainly upon release as well. And we were able, just in the first year alone, save almost $4.5 million for the state. But again, you'll see where politics and where special interest comes in, some of the challenges that we face with that. Finally, also responses to emergencies. We seem to be, emergencies are us here in Florida. I mean, we not only led, obviously, the H1N1 pandemic, providing and directing policy, protocol, public provider messaging for disease surveillance and control. We actually developed also media campaigns for which we won actually an Emmy back in 2009. We responded to the Haiti earthquake back in January of 2010. We oversaw the repatriation of almost 27,000 individuals. We provided public health as well as medical actions for responder needs, refugee health services. We were also one of the states affected by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, impacting tremendously, especially our Panhandle beaches. And I was thinking after that, you know, we had anthrax, we had Chinese drywall. I mean, you name it, and we certainly responded to it. I want to reiterate what Dr. Wisdom said. This position that I was in certainly carried the advantage of being recognized and heard by not just the medical community, but the public at large. We had a consistent and understandable messaging, certainly from the federal level down to the state, and because again, we're a very centralized health department, we were able to disseminate that information very consistently to all our 67 county health departments, of which there were about 300 sites. I had total authority over budget and the operational side of managing the health department, in addition to just being the public health advocate. So all of that was extremely important. Now the challenges. Well, like much of the nation, our public health agenda is affected by many, many factors. One of them was our economy. We have no state income tax in Florida, and certainly with a recession that we were all hit with, we were impacted substantially because We depend on tourism, and we had the second highest foreclosure rate just behind Nevada. So our Florida tourism suffered quite a lot. We also had, as I mentioned, the Gulf oil spill, which affected us as well. We had, as far as our budget, significant reductions in our staffing and in our budgetary allocation every year since 2007. From a politics standpoint, public health priorities are not always evidence-based. Powerful constituencies, special interest groups, political influences truly are what drive many times decision-making. The results, as Dr. Wisdom mentioned as well, recognizing improvements sometimes takes quite a long time, and to be able to convince the governor and the legislators that are there just until their next election cycle that they need to invest on something that won't give returns for 10, 20 years was definitely a tremendous challenge. But the position, the title, as a state's leading health advocate responsible for promoting wellness, disease, injury prevention, was important to me, was because I was able to garner the respect and the ear of a lot of our stakeholders in the community and certainly our legislators. And finally, as far as key to our effectiveness, I think it's very, very important once you start in this position to understand the political aspirations of the person that you're serving. It's not enough that you know what their political party is. My governor that I served under went from being a very right of center Republican to an independent to a Democrat. So all bets were off in trying to guess where his, what his ideal health agenda was. So try to understand that, try to gauge that. Do not assume that the greater good and that there are things that are bipartisan and that should not have a political tinge to it, because it always does, unfortunately. Realize that politics drives decision-making. It can be a tiebreaker of deciding which equally important data-supported health priority your agency should embark upon. And finally, being able to operationalize priorities is dependent upon the alignment with both not just the executive but also the legislative branch. It was an incredibly honorable stint for me. I learned an enormous amount. I was able to meet amazing people. I was able to appreciate government workers, which frequently are maligned. And in fact, the trend has been since I left the office to try to privatize everything. And the government is bad and private sector is good. And I remember talking to our current governor and saying, I have no problem at all. And I think it should be wonderful that we try to privatize as much as possible. But whoever can do it better and cheaper should be doing it. And a lot of times it is the government. Like the 340B pricing, there's just no way that the private sector frequently can compete against advantages like that. So again, I look forward to your questions, and as I said, it was an incredible honor to serve in that capacity. I think, like Dr. Wisdom said, we need a new leadership model as our environment continues to change so that we can be the best servants we can. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Bamonde. As you can see, she didn't tell you that when she walked in there, she didn't even know that the title had been changed from Secretary of Health to Surgeon General upon her first day of arrival. Try to deal with those. Our next and final speaker is Catherine Whitgert, and she is a Senior Program Director of the National Academy of State Health Policy, where she leads research and analysis on coverage and care for chronically ill and vulnerable populations. In this capacity, she oversees a portfolio that assesses how new public coverage options, delivery system reforms, and healthcare workforce development efforts intersect to affect care for vulnerable individuals and families, including people living with HIV/AIDS, those with mental health problems, behavioral health, or substance use disorders, and those with criminal justice involvement. Catherine Whitgert's job includes policy research and analysis, evaluation, and technical assistance to states. She provides individual technical assistance to state officials in Medicaid agencies, Title V, and Ryan White HIV/AIDS bureaus, and has led learning collaboratives that include Medicaid officials together with safety net providers from public health agencies and community health. She speaks to national audiences about the opportunities and challenges in serving vulnerable populations through a combination of insurance coverage and public health programs. She earned her MPH from the Yale School of Epidemiology and Public Health. Mrs. Wood.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for being here. We just had the pleasure of hearing a couple of really excellent first-person accounts of what it's like to work as a state surgeon general, so now you're getting the very much third-person point of view. So I work at an organization called the National Academy for State Health Policy, and I realize a lot of people here at APHA might not be familiar with us, so I wanted to tell you just a little bit about what we do. So we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We don't take positions on issues, but we work with state officials in different agencies, different branches of government, to discuss issues, convene forums, and really help states move forward from wherever they are at that time to improve state health policy and practice. So, with support from Dr. Wisdom and the Henry Ford Health System, we convened a meeting this past fall, to talk about the concept of state surgeons general. We invited a range of viewpoints to come to that meeting and talk with us. We had different state agencies, both current and former state officials, people who have served in the state surgeon general office, as well as those who hadn't. We also included national organizations that represent public health and healthcare sectors. So we had 10 different states represented there from both coasts. We had big states and small states. We had political diversity. So we had a very broad range of viewpoints in the room. The goal wasn't really to hear about experts about state surgeon general. I mean, I don't really know that we have experts other than people who are already sitting at this table. It was really to gather the wisdom, the insights of people who have worked in state government in varying roles on the health side of things, and ask them to consider how would a state surgeon general fit in to the system that they know and the government structure that they've all spent their careers working in. So we started the meeting with an overview of the state surgeon general models that you heard about in today's presentations, and a description of some of the opportunities and challenges that people who have served in those roles have faced. So that kind of got everybody up to speed on what is this model, how can it work, how has it worked so far. And then for the bulk of the day, we spent the time talking about potential roles and responsibilities for a state surgeon general, what the governance and financing for a state surgeon general might look like, and that's the piece that I'm going to share with you for the rest of this presentation. So one of the places that the group focused was about the Affordable Care Act and that sort of ushering in this new era for healthcare and also for public health. So we've all been starting to talk about population health, and there's not necessarily one definition of what that is, but sort of like the medical side is coming around to seeing some of the public health stuff, and in the public health world, we're learning how to maybe work more closely with some of the medical sector to improve population health. And so as we're thinking about this and how to leverage the opportunities that are in the Affordable Care Act, it's possible for a state surgeon general to be able to maybe articulate those goals. And so the group talked about possible roles for a state surgeon general that you see there, and that I'll talk about a little bit more on the next slide, and how that aligns with this triple aim of better care, better health, lower costs for the whole population. So the three primary state surgeon general roles that the group identified were to act as a medical advisor, to serve as a public health advocate and to be a health strategist within government. And then importantly, the group also talked about the role of the state surgeon general as a communicator, and that has to go across any other responsibilities that the state surgeon general might have. So the past and current surgeon generals, they've all been physicians who are capable of translating medical knowledge into state policy making, into being able to distill really complex medical information into layman's terms for a variety of audiences that can include state government officials, business leaders, the general public. We also knew that the state surgeon generals who have served have had some background in public health or experience with programs that are trying to improve the health of the population. And the state surgeon generals mostly served in a nonpartisan advisory role within state government, which allowed them direct access to the governor, the health commissioner, other leading state health policymakers. And so based on those experiences and then thinking about what a surgeon general might need to do next, these three main roles were what rose to the top for the group of experts that we pulled together. So what we talked about for most of the day was, okay, we've all agreed on this concept of a state surgeon general and the roles that they could play. How do we do that? What would that look like to put that into an existing state system of governance? And what the group thought about was that if a state wanted to adopt a surgeon general model, they would really have to evaluate their health infrastructure and determine the best way to integrate that new surgeon general role to support population health improvement goals, but not duplicate the roles of other health officials or reduce funding available to the health agencies and departments that are there. So the group talked about this in three areas of governance, financing, and sustainability. So for governance, the meeting participants noted that there are state leadership positions like health commissioner, state health officer, governor's health policy advisor, and they might have other names in your states, but there are people currently in state government whose roles are likely to intersect with the role of a state surgeon general. The four states that have had a state surgeon general or physician general have found ways to integrate that position in a way that really complements those other leadership roles without duplicating the responsibilities. But given the significant differences in the way that every state is organized and the way they've structured their health agencies, each state would have to really carefully consider where that state surgeon general model adds value to their health infrastructure and doesn't duplicate something else that's happening. A second major area of consideration for the group was financing for the state surgeon general role. The state surgeon general is likely to be located in a Department of Public Health, but as you all know, those are not usually the wealthiest of agencies in state government. And any kind of budget pressures can make it really hard to advocate for funding for a new position. And then beyond just funding the position, the meeting participants acknowledged that you really need to have adequate funding for the person to be able to do something in their role, right? You have to be able to support the staff and the resources and the programs so that a state surgeon general can work effectively in that role. The participants also agreed that whatever we do, we don't want to be taking away, we don't want to be chopping up the pie smaller. So we don't want to take money away from an existing health department agency or department or program in order to fund a state surgeon general. So to overcome that, some of the suggestions were that the state would need to secure funding through allocations from the governor or the legislature or both, which really, you need to get really strong buy-in from both both the executive and the legislative branch, a commitment to advancing the population health initiatives, the ACA, I think, gives us some leverage to that, but it's always going to depend a little bit on the politics in the state at that moment. And then finally, the group talked about sustainability, and they all agreed that having a sustained position is really important to the portfolio and the effectiveness and the way that that the way that the state Surgeon General is viewed. If there's not a strong portfolio with clear roles and responsibilities, then it could be kind of easy to eliminate the position again if you need the money or the governor's just not that into public health that year. But having it sort of weave in and out kind of takes away from that respected role that the group felt was very important to the position overall. So some of the recommendations that the group had for ensuring sustainability was that the position should be continuous in a state. It shouldn't be filled just some of the time when other criteria are met or when it's desired by a specific governor, but that there should always be someone in that role of state Surgeon General. And second is that to help that along, the position needs to be codified in state law. So that gives the state Surgeon General a legal framework for the position and an opportunity to really clearly define the roles and expectations in legislation and have some consistency from year to year. So I'm going to let Dr. Novello do our key takeaways and start off the discussion. But before I do, I also wanted to let everyone know that NASHP is writing a paper that will summarize the results of this meeting, which we're hoping to publish towards the end of this year. And I want to recognize the primary author of that paper is my colleague, Felicia Heider. She is a research analyst at NASHP, and she wasn't able to come to APHA, but a lot of what I have said today is thanks to her analysis of our meeting proceedings. So thank you.
I think the most important thing is that I have to congratulate my colleagues for staying on time. And that takes savviness and jobs that have been well done by people who are accustomed to talk in the public arena. So that's the first thing you have to learn. Once you lose your time, you lose the attention of the audience. And they have proven that in this type of jobs that we're trying to advocate, time is of the essence. And therefore, if they would have lingered, I'm sure that you would have already doing all your messages and your emails back home. And I don't think I have heard that bling. I think you're involved. But at this stage of the game, let me tell you, it's not every day that you're able to see people who have the experience of the job that they're trying to advocate. I know that, like many of us, we read it in the web, we go into the computer, we go to a conference, and we listen to someone speaking. But it's very few times in where the expertise of the job is shared with your undivided attention with all the pitfalls that have pertained getting to that top. Long time ago in the 1980s, there was a person that changed the face of public health, and that was Everett Cooper. When he was there, public health regained a respect in the national arena that was unique in 8 years, up to now. He's been the only Surgeon General that has served two terms, and that's because the president that he served two terms as well. There was not one mention of health care that was not listened in total detail unless Dr. Koop was talking about it. And I know that because I was the one who followed him, and it was petrifying to follow a giant like that, to be able to become the communicator of the country. Especially when you have an accent, but remember, we might have accents. We might speak with accents, but we don't think with an accent. So here is an idea that has been coming forward with stakeholders meeting, interviewings of people, and three people to personalize what they have done, accomplishing what we would like very much to become the pattern of the land. So What I think we can take out of this presentation is that it is not something that they were grown to do. They were put in those positions and they were able to be successful, in spite of the fact that in one model, they were competing with the person who was already the Secretary of Health of the place. In another one, the two things were put together, and in the other one, the advantage was that it became an advisor to the governor, and today practices the same job and is an academic post in the state of Arkansas. So with this job, you basically can turn it around and do what you think is best. So you can either be an advisor, you can be a person of an advocate, or you can be a strategist. But the important thing in this is, from the perspective of the presentations today, do you foresee that this is something that could be feasible at the level of the places where you live? Let me see a show of hands. The important thing in this, and I believe the cruciality of the implementation of the State Surgeon General, in my view, is unique in today's world. Like Dr. Wisdom said, science changes, and we have to change the way we approach the scientific needs. And today we have too many things, and among them we have, for the first time, the Accountable Care Act, in where it is the coverage of all the people's health in this country that had never been taken care of, plus the health disadvantages of some others. With this particular thing, and I will open the floor for discussion, remember, you have something that is unique. But I think what we have to learn is that if you are the State Surgeon General, you have to be a person of authority. You have to be a person that when you speak, the town listens. You have to be a person that is trusted by their peers. And you have to be a person that delivers in the legislature the budget that is necessary. However, in those places in where you, like Dr. Viamonte, has the combination of both under one, but different from Dr. Wisdom, that is two people at the same time. And then in Pennsylvania, when if the person is not a doctor, you have a physician general. You have the sensitivity issue of a person that believes is doing the work and the other one that is advising the governor. So you have to also be terrifically diplomatic in your work. But unless you do a dual advantage of being trusted by the one who really cares about you, which is the governor, the potentiality of you being dismissed by the one that is the job of the health and not the advisor, you have to be terrifically diplomatic. So when you're in those positions, don't forget to always give accolades to those one who do the daily work in the realm of public health while you are becoming the face that is recognized by the public. And more than anything, it would be great if by any means this job would be one that is like the FBI director, that your tenure does not just end at the end of the governor's term, because there has to be some continuity of this institutional memory for the future. So it seems to me that there is the possibility of this becoming something important, in the sense that with the healthcare of today and the needs of states that might not be equal in funding and monetary needs, that those states that are in proximity and have a problem that could be felt across the borders, that the Office of the State Surgeon General can unite with the State Surgeon Generals of the others and under one budget solve one issue. That would be terrifically important. We have to think about it in the perspective of implementation and distribution beyond your border, because trust will do that. And the other one would be the Surgeon General of the United States has many, many responsibilities. But if the Surgeon Generals of the state become equal to the CDC, the sole workers of the epidemics, the brains of I am the one who touches the public with my hands and my needs because I know my public, then you can become an advocate or even a worker for something major that can be utilized by the Office of the Surgeon General as someone that would promote his or her agenda and helping them accomplish goals, not just in reports or in actuarial needs. So I foresee that this, if implemented in the States with the title of Surgeon General, in the minds of people believing that there was a Everett coup, it would have credibility. It would have sustainability. It might get us some budget, but more than anything, it will get us the respect that public health is a term that is very comprehensive, and one person at the helm can make this better for all of us. So that's why I think this is crucial, and that's why I wanted to summarize it in that context, to put it into your minds when you go back to your places and try to make sure that the Secretary of Health title might be changed to the Surgeon General, State Surgeon General, whatever you are, for the purpose of the future of public health implementation and help. So now I would like to open the floor for discussion. And remember, this is kind of homey. Don't be afraid. Ask whatever, because it's very rare that you will see two state surgeon generals of this caliber sharing their recommendations and the potentiality of guiding you against some pitfalls that you will find. Okay, let's start. Identify yourself and see to whom would you like to. Take her question, Dr. Wynn.
Right. The question was, how can, since we mentioned that the state surgeon general role serves, or the state surgeon general serves as the people's doctor, how can we get the people more involved in advocating for the post? And I think that's a very, very good question. Because we have been working with government, you know, state agencies, government agencies, people in leadership in public health, and in our conversations have not involved the target populations or the people that we are striving to serve. So in when I served, we had the ability then of, we constantly tried to reach out to people. So for instance, when I talked about Michigan Steps Up and the website that we had 31,000 people that filled out a four-question survey about their health, and then we captured their email address. At that time, I mean, that's why the sustainability piece is important. It would have been great to really reach out to those 31,000 people who already engaged with us to identify how they can help promote the post. I think it's such a great question, because I'm not so sure that the general public understands all the nuances that we're addressing here. And I think that's a real opportunity for us to identify ways to engage the general public, so work at grass tops as well as grassroots in terms of driving this this model. I think they need to understand the benefits and the value, and then identify ways that they could actually drive the model. I'd love to hear from Dr. Villamontañez too.
I think there's a lot of the public that knows and goes to political meetings, supports local legislators, belongs to professional associations that have lobbyists that can forward agendas. So writing letters to the editor, I mean, there are just all sorts of things in your professional and public life that you can let your voice be heard. So if it's something that you're interested in, there are all sorts of commissions and boards that the governor sets up that you can volunteer for. And again, you know, just by talking to people that can then forward your information, writing letters, as I said, or speaking directly to your local legislators, I think would be very important. But that is very, you know, that to be able to get the support and the understanding and the value from the people that you're serving would be critical in order to maintain the, you know, these positions. Thank you.
Kathy, would you like to discuss the possibility of us talking to the National Governors Association also as a way and means to easing some of these issues?
So once again, with the caveat that NASHP does not take positions about these kinds of things, we do, we recognize, and I think the group of stakeholders that we got together recognize that if you're going to do something like this, it is disruptive to the current system, right? And so some people might be nervous about that. So I think some of, if this is something that people are interested in, there's definitely a need to talk with those who are currently fulfilling some of these roles and responsibilities and work together with with them. So the governor's offices, the health departments, the sometimes there's a secretary of health or a commissioner of health, or you know, you'll have to look in your state to see who that person is, and to make sure to work with them from the beginning, because probably surprising them with this is not going to help. So I would just encourage that kind of open discussion with the current group of state health policymakers.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about the history of the term surgeon general. I heard you say that you use the term physician general, and then Jamila's question got me thinking about sort of this public perception or the public demand for services, or especially with the popularity of some of the shows on TV now.
Well, the people expect me to take out their appendix, but we have nothing to, as a matter of fact, most surgeon generals have been primary care physicians for pediatricians, until Dr. Carmona, who then is a surgeon. So it comes from 100 years ago, where you really had, the surgeon was really the important member that would solve almost all issues in the land. And that was the title that was used then in medicine. So it became like that. And interesting enough, the office of the Surgeon General, or the Surgeon General per se, we have been 18 of us, and there are only now 6 of us alive. And the beauty about it is totally bipartisan, but it was only until 1960 that we are a member of the Uniformed Services of the United States. We do not bear arms, but we bear advice. But in times of conflict, we can be able to help the military ones, like it happened during Korea, and what it happens during the Gulf War, in where we were the ones who were able to appease the fires in Kuwait. So we have been used for that. But until the last reservist is used, only then will be used to do something military. But we are part of the uniformed services. We are 13 categories, so we all start as ensign, as and a lieutenant. So the important thing about that is not only until 1960 that we became a political job, serendipity. President Kennedy was appointed on that particular day to the post, and on that particular day, the Surgeon General of the Public Health Service had changed to become a new one. So from that moment on, we have become a political person that ascends with the president. In spite of that, we are supposed to be the voice of the nation and bipartisan. And it takes us more time to be bipartisan than to be knowledgeable. Because as I always say, I happen to be Hispanic, but I am the Surgeon General of all Americans. And so that stays in people's minds. So this becomes a very trusted name and a trusted position. And therefore, it is something that was, there was a Surgeon General that was 32 years. There's one that left and then came back for 4 more before 1960. Now it goes steady with the office of the president. So it becomes either a Democrat or a Republican affiliation, but we must be bipartisan. That answers your question? Yes?
So I'm curious, my name is Shirley Sherian, I work for Minnesota State Department of Health. And for Florida, and I'm the chief here, and after about a dual role, the health commissioner and state health officer. So your title is Surgeon General and Secretary of Health. So I just think about our commissioner of health, and he, you know, he's a pediatrician, he does a lot of public health advocacy and health strategy. So what would be the advantage of maybe Minnesota?
Well, Minnesota is such a different state that probably they are already doing what we are advocating. However, it seems to me that if you go in front of an audience and you say, I'm the Secretary of Health or the Health Commissioner, it has an impact if you already have the credibility, the title and the credibility will not change. But if the state decides to have then the Surgeon General of Minnesota and the Health Department, maybe it might be a little bit different, especially when you already have given a chair in public health to Dr. Joycelyn Elder. So you believe in the post as conveying the right information. So it's for the states to decide what they want to do. But remember that some of the persons that have become your Secretary of Health might not be the best communicators. And so there might be someone that then takes the pulpit to be the director of communication, the director of leadership, the surrogate of the governor to go and find out what seems to be the message of the land, which is basically the job of the Surgeon General. We are there, we are the ears and the feet of the president on the ground and the secretary of health to tell them what the public needs, what the public wants. And that I don't think every state has, because we are so overwhelmed with the everyday problems of public health, the natural ones, that we forget that sometimes we have to be advocates to the higher up, so that that one that is back there that I cannot get to it is hurt by the top. So in some states we don't need to, but in some states the addition of that might create a little bit better of the pulpit.
Well, we've had our issues too in the past, and I guess now I think about it, we don't require our health commissioner to have an MD or be an MD.
Well, this, in my book, it seems to me that if you're going to be the health commissioner, you should be at least an MD, because it creates a difficulty. When you are the Secretary of Health of the United States, it doesn't matter, because you have the Surgeon General and you have the Assistant Secretary of Health. Both of them are physicians. So you have all those people to give you the advice. But when you are in a state alone with health problems and you are in a state of emergency and you call us and your doctor so-and-so, then I can talk to you in a lingo that I assume you're going to get your feet on the ground running. If I have to explain the problem, I think we lose time for taking people into consideration. So it's not against the states that do not have it, because sometimes just having the title does not mean anything. Nobody home. But it depends on the state. Oh, yes, please.
I was just asked a very good question by Dr. Wisdom. What would I have done differently in my role? I'll backtrack just for a moment. I was interviewed for the position of Secretary of Health, and the day that the governor announced me, and it was a big press conference, I was standing next to him, and he was reading my biography, and he said, "Now I'd like to present Dr. Anna Viamonte Ross, the first state surgeon general for Florida." And I looked over his shoulder and I thought, where is he reading that? No one had even uttered the word surgeon general to me. I had no idea what that meant. I was neither a general nor a surgeon. I was a radiologist. I mean, but anyways, what would I have been done differently? I think I would have done nothing differently. I thought my role was not only operationally to manage a very complex health system in the state of Florida, but also to be an advisor, a face for public health in the state. It was just the terminology of Surgeon General. I'll give you a funny story also. My children could not stop laughing. One time I was addressed and I was introduced as Florida's first Surgeon General. They thought that great. And they said, "Did you even get a little hat or anything?" So I think it's just that the public at large, first, have no idea what public health is. Secretary of Health, Secretary of Transportation, they have no clue really what any of that means. It does resonate, though, Surgeon General. They've heard of it from the federal standpoint. And again, if there's some way sort of have a consistent message from the federal level down to the states on very significant public health issues, again, being a state surgeon general. So it's just a perception, but I don't think truly I would have done or behaved any differently if my title had not been that. Yes.
My question is real open. We see more and more of this politicization and dismissal of public health and science in general, especially with issues like climate change. What can we all do to combat this and convince those who have a role to it?
Okay, repeat it again so I can have it.
So what can be done to combat this and convince those in power to take action so the politicization is dismissible?
He wants to make sure that how can we get involved in doing all the important things in public health, among them climate change and the things that are pertinent to today. I think that has a lot to do with the particular state and the particular constituency. And if that is one thing that is right in their book, it will be solved before anything else. But in some others like ours, look at Bahamonde. She had the hurricanes. She had the 340 for the people that were incarcerated. She had all the problems that had to do with the tobacco and the lowering of the incidence. So it depends on the state what they want to do. And having been the health commissioner of the state of New York, I had September 11. And one of the things that I thought it was very important there was You have to know the culture of the people you treat to be able to help them in their quest. And the case in point, I'll give a small example, was the issue of when everybody was running around not knowing what to do in September 11. We said, okay, the people are depressed, let's go ahead and put everybody out there, a psychologist, social worker, psychiatrist, I want you out there. Second, you don't ask people if they have Medicaid, you assume that they are incompatible and you give them whatever they want. At the end of the month, I look into the chart for mental health and it was flat. I look at the chart for cardiology and it was way up. No one knew the culture that when you're a minority and you're asked how do you feel, they don't say I'm depressed, they say I have a pain in my heart. So they did an EKG rather than sending them to a psychologist. So cultural knowledge of your people are going to be extremely important. That's why that person with that title might be able to have people communicating to them what they might not tell the Secretary of Health that they might see as a bureaucrat. And vice versa, it could be the other way around. They might trust more the Secretary of Health than the Surgeon General that they see as a politician. So the trust is going to be crucial. The cultural knowledge is going to be crucial. And the ability to communicate at the level of understanding of the public is going to be crucial. Because now that we're older, don't we value more those professors who made the difficult sound easy? Rather than the one who always talks so high that you say, boy, he is brilliant. Well, when you went home, it took you 3 hours to see what he said or she said. So difficult, make easy in communication is going to be crucial for this person.
I think what's key is a leadership, the leadership competency. The role is very much a leadership role. And the person, you talked about climate change, who is responsible in a particular state around an issue? And what was, you know, very helpful in the state of Michigan was that when various efforts or concerns came up, they would go to a person, and then even I remember when Detroit was considered one of the fattest cities in the state, the mayor called me. I mean, all kind of, because they figured there's one person who's got some level of responsibility and accountability to the public in terms of sharing what was done. So believe me, that's in part how Michigan Steps Up, our Healthy Lifestyles campaign, evolved, was because there was a point person to go to. So I think that leadership role and the accountability, and we didn't talk a lot about it, but I think the role could serve in a tremendous way in terms of accountability. We've talked about childhood obesity rates rising. Who's accountable? Who's at the state level, the federal level? Who is looking into that to determine how do we drive these rates down in a strategic and a systematic way? It's so I think the responsibility and the accountability are two key roles, and it all falls under leadership.
One other thing. If you even forget about the public, even our health professionals have no idea what public health is or value that. I teach at the medical school, and I remember just from my own experience as a medical student, I trained and went to school at the University of Miami at Jackson Memorial Hospital, big county hospital. Our county health department was across the street. I had no clue what they did. I thought, that's where the really poor people go. That's where if you have an STD, you go. I knew a little bit about, you know, immunization, traveler's immunization, maybe the birth certificates and death certificates. That's it. That was my knowledge of public health. And that's why when I started teaching at the medical school, I thought, the medical students need to know. If they don't know, how could we even expect the public to know? So, in fact, we make sure that they go to the health department. They meet with the different directors of the different areas. Their exam, we give them a fictitious family and what services they can provide and direct their families to in the communities that all are public health based. And so we really drill into them because, again, the average physician has no idea what public health is, nor values that. So how can we expect the public and certainly our legislators? Again, nobody's, you know, banging down their door to give them money and lobbyists trying to, you know, get them to fund climate change initiatives or obesity initiatives. None of that. None of that. You're in the way back of the line trying to make your point. So, yes.
Actually explored on the effect of different activities. of this model in your position to lead the outcome of public health.
You are a mind reader. Because one of the things that we always want is how do we measure the success of this position? And but I wanted to see if you were intelligent enough to come with that without me telling you that was out there already planned by us. So what and how would people suggest we measure this impact? And Kathy, do you have any idea of how can we do that, or this is something that we want to do for this pilot?
When we got our group together, this was not a question that we were able to have the time to talk about with them, but one of the ideas that Dr. Wisdom is interested in exploring is a pilot of state Surgeon General models in other states. And so this would be a really important thing, I think, to put out there, because if anyone's going to fund the pilot, they're going to want to know if that pilot worked. And we're obviously also all going to be interested in what does that role, you know, what kind of extra bang for your buck do you get from that state Surgeon General role? So I have to go away, I'm sorry, because I have a call with CMS and we're a little nonprofit, and when your funder wants to talk to you, you're going to go talk to them. So I'm going to go do that, and then they're going to fill me in on what the answer is to how do we evaluate the state Surgeon General role.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy. I think we talked about in our presentations, job descriptions, clear accountabilities, and I think having those in place a priori, so if you were to require that the state Surgeon General address the childhood obesity epidemic and actually drive it down to a certain level, that would be a measurable element. So it gets back to that accountability piece and what the role and responsibility of that post would be. And I think it can be more than it has been, but certainly have very specific accountabilities and metrics associated with it.
Okay, I just want to be able to say one more thing on that, if I may, since we've been so good. It seems to me that if we can have this position implemented in most states, wouldn't it be more feasible to go to them when the time comes to select these United States Surgeon General from that base, from that cadre who already has been trained, knows policy, responsibility, leadership, communication, and has the credibility of the people that they have represented? So I am speculating, but it would be a wonderful way to be able to have those in the eyes of the political system of the moment to, from there, select what it would be then the Surgeon General of the United States already with a trainee that has accomplished and is knowledgeable in the field. So the repercussions of what we're trying to implement go beyond just having a title and sounding good. It goes beyond advancing careers in where you can really just sit and start running with what you need to do, because the day that you become the Surgeon General, they don't take 2 weeks for you to be prepared for solving the issues of the land. So like Dr. Wisdom said, the problem of the land, have you been able to drop significantly? And if so, then did it did better with the Secretary of Health, or did it did better with the conscientious communication of the problem by the person that is right there with you trying to be the advocate of public health? The final one, let's get a man to talk. We haven't had one at all. And then you.
Thank
yes?
you first for sharing your experiences and your perspective on this. My question is pretty simple. We talked about Florida, New York, and Michigan. How many states actually have this position today? Three.
Arkansas, Michigan, and Florida. That's it. Wow.
Although Michigan no longer exists.
Right.
No, the post. Michigan exists.
I hope so. And then the position, general position, is in Pennsylvania. Only when the Secretary of Health is not a physician.
And since Dr. Bamonde has not been there, the two Surgeon Generals that have followed her have been military doctors. Which one?
National Guard.
I didn't understand your question.
My question, the history is with, you said it's a military position.
It's the uniformed services, yes.
I'm curious if there's been any discussions to link it to the National Guard in each of the individual states to give it some structure.
I don't think that will make a difference. I think it's best to try to unite it to the United States Surgeon General and be part of this prevention task force that has been unique in the land, implemented by President Obama, of which Dr. Wisdom is a member, and then make then the network to be able to use this post to be able to implement the prevention agenda for the United States, and that might be a nice way to start measuring the impact of this particular one. But as it's growing, let's not give it one more bureaucracy. Have you guys learned some? Are you willing to take this back to your states and talk a little bit to your leaders in health? And then let's see if this becomes something very important for the future. So we are on time, and we want to appreciate you coming, and I hope you learned something. And thank you so much for coming, and I'll see you next year. Thank you so much.